Well, hello and welcome to the Archaeology News Weekly. I don't know what happened to last week, but I can assure you I am here now. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources. To view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. And of course, a little thank you to those people that you don't hear about as well, without which this would not be possible. A big thank you to Debbie out in the USA, who edits these news stories for me. And of course, to Dave Horrocks up in Canada, who does a masterful job at mastering the final MP3. And of course, Diego at Stone Pages, without which we wouldn't have these at all. Should I thank myself? No, I think what we'll do is get straight on to the news. There's evidence of clan-based societies in ancient Kerala in India, and English Heritage steps in to rescue a prehistoric earthwork. Now, your Stonehenge's news for the day, it's yes, unbelievable, the inflatable Stonehenge Roadshow goes on the road. Genetic studies uncover a new path to Polynesia, and legislation forces British archaeologists to rebury their finds. The earliest rock art engravings of an American mammoth are found, or are they? And we look at the significance of play in the Bronze Age Indus Valley. Stone Ring may provide evidence that the Aborigines in Australia were astronomers, and there's a Stone Age ritual object found in Poland. Can't wait. Northern hunters were slowed down by the advance of Neolithic farmers, a new study shows, and an ancient nomadic camp is discovered in Mexico. Mesolithic beads are found in a Welsh dolmen site, and 10,000-year-old stone carvings are also found in Timor. It seems that the Vikings revered Stone Age objects. And finally, you can't make this one up, a Scottish standing stone is standing no more, as it fell over. Anyway, remember, you can be listening to this on Stone Pages Archaeo News app as well, and keep up with the news as it happens. So, let's start off today's podcast. Earthen burials were recently found in Amaravathi and Cherunthoni in India. The findings are evidence of the existence of a clan-based society in the Megalithic period in the high ranges of the Idukki district of Kerala. Heavy man-made granite structures called Virakalu were found in many areas. Virakalu are marked burial places of perhaps warriors in prehistoric times. The urns and granite structures are the remains of one of the earliest known inhabitants and are scattered around various places. Unfortunately, they are now facing increasing threat from construction. These urns were first found around about 1817 when a team from the Madras Army conducted a survey. However, things are not looking good, as no serious archaeological studies have ever been undertaken, and local people and farm workers are usually unearthing these finds accidentally. So as a result, the urns and the metallic items that are found with them are often destroyed or lost. Well, let's hope that something can be done about that now that it's been highlighted. Now, across to the UK, where another thing is being highlighted but also being dealt with. English Heritage have come to the rescue of a prehistoric earthwork in Rotherham Wood in South Yorkshire after it was being damaged by mountain bikers who used parts of it to make a ramp. The site, called Roman Ridge, is a 2,000-year-old earthwork that predates the arrival of the Romans in Britain. Experts believe it was constructed to mark territories or perhaps grazing areas for cattle in an area which once marked the southern borders of the Brigantes. They were the largest tribe in Celtic Britain, who lived in what is now North England. The portion of the earthwork, which stands up to 2 metres tall and stretches for 730 metres into Swinton Wood, is a rare survival of a tribal boundary. The feature once covered 12 miles between Winklebank and the area beyond Wath-upon-Dearn. It will now be repaired after English Heritage signed an agreement with its owners, who are urging walkers to report any damage that they notice. The monument is fragile. It's fortunate that it survived for so long. Elsewhere, the plight of many of the region's earthworks and scheduled monuments are a cause of concern for English Heritage, who say that up to 48 are now at serious risk. Walkers can report any incidents of damage being caused to the Roman Ridge site by emailing swintonwood swintonwood@gmail.com. So that was swintonwood@gmail.com if you are walking around that area and notice any damage. Now, continuing the good work, yes, to celebrate the new BBC Two series on the ancient Britons, a Stonehenge model is now touring the UK. English heritage experts are helping BBC Hands-On History make the most of a new BBC Two TV series, A History of Ancient Britain, which started on February the 9th. They're putting out all the stops to get an inflatable scale model of one Stonehenge trilithon, which has two uprights and a lintel, as accurate as possible before it goes on a whistle-stop tour of a five city centre shopping centres from the 21st through to the 25th of February. English heritage policy researchers, archaeological investigators, surveyors and historians have all been keen to join forces and investigate a variety of archived information, including 3D data from a previous survey of the monument in 1993, as well as old plans and photographs of the 1958 re-erection, in order to supply exactly the correct dimensions. Others have also helped to supply images, information and check details for a series of popular, jointly branded learning resources as part of an ongoing partnership between the BBC Learning and English Heritage Education. Prehistoric timelines and group activity guides are currently being handed out free of charge to families visiting Stonehenge. These can also be downloaded from the BBC Hands-On History website, where teachers, parents and students can find events, a map of sites to visit, animations featuring the Hands-On History mini time traveller, and much more. The Stonehenge Roadshow will challenge families to help solve the mystery of how the stones are moved, and will feature interpretation boards and an interactive mini-drama led by historical interpreters. Scheduled to visit shopping centres in five locations. There's no booking required and entrance is free, but you'll have to go to the website for the listings of times and addresses. But note, a parent or guardian must accompany persons under the age of 16. Well, yes, I have to confess that I'm well over that one. But I can't wait to find, I hope, it's coming up to Scotland, even if it is a classic English heritage site. Right, well, we're now going to head off to somewhere a little bit warmer, the islands of Polynesia. They were first inhabited around 3,000 years ago. But where these people came from has long been a hot topic of debate among scientists. The most commonly accepted view, based on archaeological and linguistic evidence, as well as genetic studies, is that Pacific Islanders were from the latter part of a migration south and eastwards from Taiwan, which began around 4,000 years ago. But a new research by scientists at the University of Leeds has found that the link to Taiwan does not stand up to scrutiny. In fact, the DNA of current Polynesians can be traced back to migrants from the Asian mainland that had already settled in the islands close to New Guinea some 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. Lead researcher Professor Martin Richards explained that most previous studies looked at a small piece of mitochondrial DNA, but for this research he studied 157 complete mitochondrial genomes. In addition to smaller samples from over 4,750 people from across Southeast Asia and Polynesia. He also reworked their dating techniques to significantly reduce the margin of error. This leads him to be confident that the Polynesian population came from people who arrived in the Bismarck Archipelago of Papua New Guinea thousands of years before the supposed migration from Taiwan took place. Nevertheless, most linguists maintain that the Polynesian languages are part of the Austronesian language family, which does originate in Taiwan. And most archaeologists see evidence for Southeast Asian influence on the appearance of the Lapita culture in the Bismarck Archipelago around 3,500 years ago. Characterized by distinctive dentate stamped ceramics and obsidian tools, Lapita is also a marker for the earliest settlers of Polynesia. Professor Richards and his co-researcher argue that the linguistic and cultural connections are due to smaller migratory movements from Taiwan that did not leave any substantial genetic impact on the pre-existing population. It does seem that there was a voyaging corridor between the islands of Southeast Asia and the Bismarck Archipelago carrying maritime traders who brought their language and artifacts and perhaps helped to create the impetus for the migration into the Pacific. It's actually quite interesting the way that genetics is going just now. And in fact, it seems to me, as we've been reporting over the last few years, that indeed the genetics itself seems to be a bit under scrutiny, where you can actually use it to prove one thing and then it changes to another thing. So as time goes by, let's hope that it becomes more and more precise. Now, in the UK, British archaeologists have expressed their concerns about legislation that requires human remains discovered in ancient settlements to be reburied within 2 years. In a series of letters to UK Justice Secretary Ken Clark, leading archaeological professors and members of RESCUE, the British Archaeological Trust, explain how the legislation is causing severe damage to research and the advancement of knowledge. The dispute centres on legislation introduced by the Ministry of Justice in 2008, which requires all human remains excavated at digs in England and Wales to be reburied within 2 years, regardless of their age. The decision means that scientists have too little time to study the bones and other human remains of potential national and cultural significance. The ruling applies to any piece of bone uncovered at around 400 dig sites, including the remains of 60 or so bodies that were found at Stonehenge in 2008 that date back to 3000 BCE. The arrangements, the archaeologists say, may result in the squandering of future discoveries at sites such as Happisburg in Norfolk, where excavations are continuing after the discovery of stone tools made by early humans 950,000 years ago. If human remains were to be found there, they would be the oldest human fossils in Northern Europe and the first indication of exactly what species it was. Under the current practices of the law, those remains would have to be reburied and effectively destroyed. Mike Pitts, editor of British Archaeology, notes that this applies to everything. If they were to find a Neanderthal fossil or a Roman skeleton, it would all have to be reburied within 2 years. Prior to 2008, guidelines allow for the proper curation and study of bones of sufficient age and historical interest. The Ministry of Justice assured archaeologists 2 years ago that this ruling was an interim measure, but it so far failed to revise its decision. Mike Parker Pearson, an archaeologist at Sheffield University, said that whereas we have museum collections of ancient and prehistoric human remains that have been dug up, in some cases hundreds of years ago, we're about to lose all of the well-excavated, well-documented skeletal material that's been excavated since 2008. The issue has come to the fore because the first special licenses governing the removal of skeletons are now up for renewal. Scientists can apply for extensions to hold bones for longer periods, but archaeologists says the process was needlessly bureaucratic and that the remains would have to go back in the ground anyway. The Ministry of Justice said that in a statement, the original review that was undertaken in 2008 because the 1857 Burial Act lacked powers to authorise exhumation and retention, citing health and decency laws. He tells archaeologists that they are welcome to apply to extend the time limit for reburial, and that a number have already done so, and no applications have so far been refused. The ministry, however, has no guidelines on where or how the remains should be reburied or what records should be kept. So come on, Ministry of Justice, get your act together. In the USA, on a cliff overlooking the floodplain of the San Juan River in Utah, rock art specialists have examined several highly stylized images carved into the rock face, including what they believe to be the first example of prehistoric Native American rock art showing a mammoth. While such images are common in the caves of Europe, they are surprisingly unknown in the New World. Several other American mammoth images have surfaced in the past 2 centuries, but until recently all had either disappeared or been shown to be forgeries. Of course, further tests on the recent discovery are needed before the final verdict is reached. The first conclusion was that there was no evidence that the engraving was made by modern metal tools, since there were no sharp edges or metal shavings to be seen. The next was that the weathering of the engraved lines and the amount of change to the colour of the exposed rock surface were greater than those observed on other nearby carvings from periods of history more recent than the Ice Age, leading the researchers to conclude that the carvings really were of ancient origin. Convinced that this image is not a forgery, the researchers then set out to confirm that it also isn't an accident, finding several key distinguishing marks. A high dome-shaped head, two curved tusks and a long trunk has convinced them that the artist truly intended this image to portray a mammoth. They particularly drew attention to a small detail, that of two elongated fingers at the end of the trunk. This feature is greatly diminished in living Asian and African elephants, but European cave art shows it is common and pronounced feature amongst Ice Age mammoths. According to the researchers, this can be hard evidence that it's not a crude forgery, since most people do not think the trunk with a finger and a thumb when thinking about a mammoth. They also add that the most recent forgeries have been standalone, single images, while the San Juan River mammoth is just one image on a panel of several engravings, all showing a similar style and comparable weathering. Well, in a field plagued with exquisite artifacts that turn out to be hoaxes, there's a chance that this engraving may allow researchers in the region to have something new to be looking at and looking out for when examining rock art. Now, let's have some fun. Play was a central element of people's lives as far back as 4,000 years ago. This has been revealed by an archaeological thesis from the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, which investigates the social significance of the phenomena of play and games in the Bronze Age Indus Valley in present-day Pakistan. It's not uncommon for archaeologists investigating old settlements to come across play and game-related finds, but within established archaeology, these types of finds have often been disregarded. L.K. Rogers' daughter, the author of the thesis, explains that these have been regarded, for example, as signs of harmless pastimes and thus considered less important for research, or have been reinterpreted based on some ritual aspects or symbols of social status. She studied play-related artefacts found at excavations in the ruins of the ancient city of Mohenjo-Daro in present-day Pakistan. The remains constitute the largest urban settlement from the Bronze Age in the Indus Valley, a cultural complex that dates back to 2600 BCE. The settlement is difficult to interpret. For example, archaeologists have not found any remains of temples or palaces. It has therefore been tough to offer an opinion on exactly how the settlement was managed and how any elite class marked itself out. Elke's studies shows that almost every 10th find from the ruined city is actually play-related. They include, for instance, different forms of dice and gaming pieces. In addition, the examined finds have not been scattered all over. Repetitive patterns have been discerned in the spatial distribution, which may indicate specific locations where games were played. The marked quantity of play-related finds and the structured distribution shows that playing was already an important part of people's everyday lives more than 4,000 years ago. The objective of determining the social significance of the actual games challenges established ways of thinking. Elke feels it's an instrument that can be used to come up with interpretations that are closer to the individual person, hoping to gain another, more socially embedded approach to understand an incredibly complicated settlement. Is it just a pile of rocks placed in a semicircle, or proof that Australian Aborigines were astronomers since ancient times? After years of meticulous examination, a group of Australia's most distinguished astrophysicists are starting to believe it's the latter. Dubbed Wurrijuang, the egg-shaped ring of stones about 50 metres in diameter has its major axis almost exactly east-west. At its western end, the highest point of the circle are three prominent waist-high stones. In 2003, Jay Morrison pointed out that some outlying stones to the west of the circle, as viewed from these three stones, seem to indicate the setting position of the sun at equinoxes and solstices. In the study published 5 years later, astrophysicist Professor Ray Norris of the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization and other researchers confirmed these alignments, showing that the straight sides of the circle also indicate the solstices. Norris said that the precise alignment of the stones proved it was constructed to map the movements of the sun. This wasn't done by guesswork. It had required very careful measurements. If the stones go back 10,000 years, they would predate the Egyptians, the pyramids, and the Stonehenge. Though what exactly that's got to do with Australia, I have to confess I don't really know. Anyway, they add that there is enough evidence there to make it look like these people actually did know about these specific directions. The problem with all of this is you can never be 100% certain. One often questions theirself, are we constructing something with our 21st century minds that wasn't actually intended by the people who built it? Skeptics do raise some doubts as the outliers at Wurundjeri are only accurate to a few degrees, and being relatively small, they could have been moved. Also, besides the outliers indicating the solstice is an equinox, there's an additional outlier whose significance is unclear. In any case, there are other stone arrangements in Victoria that do indicate the cardinal point. From this, we may conclude that local Aboriginal people knew these directions with some precision, presumably by observing celestial bodies. But as they say, what exactly do they mean? A Stone Age era artifact carved with multiple zigzags and what is likely a woman with spread legs suggests that fertility rituals may have been important to early Europeans, according to new research. The object is made out of a large elk antler and has been radiocarbon dated to 10,900 years ago. Thomas Plonka, a University of Warsaw archaeologist, and his colleagues analysed the object unearthed at a farm at Swidwin in Poland. At first, the scientists believed the geometrical figure carved onto the antler could have been either the mentioned woman or a nude man raising his hands. Difficult one to get that one wrong, but anyway. Measurements to determine the ratio of the stick figure limbs, in addition to comparisons with other early human representations, led the researchers to support the woman with the spread legs interpretation. They think the zigzag lines are connected to water and symbolise life, adding that the lines also appear to have been carved by different individuals. That may suggest that some group effort was involved in the creation of this object. A geological study found that in ancient times there were a number of bodies of water in the region. Consequently, the role of the aquatic environment as a source of food and perhaps transport thoroughfare gained importance, the scientists concluded. Giant elks were the most imposing animals on the European plain. Scientists believe the elk was selected and killed on purpose to make the object, which has served a role in rituals for many years. The researchers aren't certain if the images on the carved antler are associated with Venus figurines, statuettes of women with exaggerated sexual figures that date to as early as 35,000 years. Some Venus figurines have been excavated in Poland, not too far away from the Swidwin site. This is another one of these stories which actually makes you think about what archaeology is. It's very easy to actually take all this and look at zigzags and decide it's water, which is a decent conclusion to come to. But what about, could it be lightning? Or could it be the didactic images that you see when you press your eyes in the dark? There are lots of ideas about what this could represent. And it'll keep us guessing, well, forever, which is the lovely thing about archaeology. Get yourself a cup of cocoa, a cup of tea or a glass of wine and sit and just discuss what it all means. Well, on that esoteric thought, one of the most significant socio-economic changes in the history of humanity took place around 10,000 years ago when the Near East went from an economy based on hunting and gathering, known as the Mesolithic, to another kind based on agriculture, the Neolithic. Farmers rapidly entered the Balkan region and the peninsula and advanced gradually throughout the rest of Europe. Various theories had been proposed over recent years to explain this process, and now physicists from the University of Girona in Spain have, for the first time, presented a new model to explain how the Neolithic front slowed down as it moved towards the north of the continent. Niels Isern, a physicist at the university and lead author of the study, said that the model shows that the high density of hunter-gatherers in northern Europe limited the farmers' dispersal and reproduction. Between 8,000 and 9,000 years ago, the first farmers from Asia were already cultivating land, that's what's now Greece. But in the areas now occupied by places like United Kingdom, Denmark and northern Germany, this did not happen until another 3,000 years later. The reaction diffusion model explains the archaeological data and the decline in the speed of the progress of the Neolithic front. It's based on two mathematical effects relating to the availability of space for the incomers. The first, the dispersal of farmers dependent on the spatial variation in the population density of hunter-gatherers, and the second, a modified population growth equation. The density of hunter-gatherers was higher in northern latitudes, which enables the model to explain the deceleration of the Neolithic transition in Europe. This was explained by Joachim Fort, the other author of the study. The authors also stressed that their same model could be applied for many other examples of the invasion fronts, in which indigenous populations and invaders compete for a space within a unique biological niche, both in terms of natural habitats and microbiological assays. Be interesting to see how this one works. Of course, the big problem that we have is information. For example, in Scotland, we have, at last count, around about 4 or 5 Neolithic houses. So working out exactly where the Neolithic people, the early Neolithic people were in Scotland, and, of course, the population of the Mesolithic in Scotland is going to be tricky. You're never going to get an exact figure there, but I wish them all the best. Right, into the municipality of Ensenada in Mexico. Archaeologists from the National Institute of Anthropology and History have discovered 8 archaeological sites, some of them occupied 8,000 years ago by nomadic hunters. Lithic tools were found at the settlements, mainly made from obsidian, similar to those discovered in Riverside County in California in the USA. The archaeologists explained that the ancient indigenous dwellers did not build constructions. They slept and ate inside caves, where intact vestiges of the last nomadic group that dwelled there have been found. Among the items discovered are pipe fragments, lithic artifacts like arrowheads, and ceramics, and the remains of animals consumed by these early people, such as mollusks, shark, dolphin, deer, wild sheep, and pronghorn. A great number of bonfires were also found, and the remains will allow scientists to date the various occupation periods using C14. According to preliminary studies, the archaeologists proposed 3 different stages of occupation. The earliest could be between 8 to 9,000 years ago, corresponding to the Paleo-Indian period, and other material from around 3,000 years ago, corresponding to the Archaic Age. The latest could also correspond to the Cocomi culture, which was approximately 1,000 years old. The project's coordinator commented that the caves have different sizes, the most important being the Caro Cave, measuring approximately 20 metres square, where a lot of material has been found. In fact, it's been calculated that families of 5 to 7 dwelt in each rock shelter. Deposits of agate, rhyolite and obsidian were also identified. According to a specialist, they were exploited by the inhabitants to manufacture their tools. The lithic objects are now undergoing chemical analysis at the University of California in Berkeley. Right, back to our friend George Nash. A recent excavation led by him in November 2010 at the Trefail Stone in southwest Wales, originally a portal dolmen transformed in later times to a standing stone, has revealed a small assemblage of exotic artifacts, including 3 drilled shale beads, identical to those found at a nearby early Mesolithic coastal habitation site. Until recently, little was known about the stone's use and origin. A geophysical survey undertaken in September 2010 revealed the remains of a kidney-shaped cairn, and it was within this clear feature that the 3 perforated shale beads were found. These items, each measuring about 4.5 centimetres in diameter, were found within a disturbed cairn or post-cairn deposit. Based on the discovery of 690 perforated beads found at the coastal seasonal camp of Nab Head in southern Pembrokeshire, it's possible that the 3 Trefail beads are contemporary. Microwell analysis on one of the beads was inconclusive, but the perforation appears to have the same microwell abrasions as those found at Nab Head. The beads from the Nab Head site were oval-shaped and water-worn. Each disc was uniform in shape and thickness and had been drilled using an all-type flint tool. It's possible or probable that the Nab's Head beads and those from Trefail were made for adornment, either sewn onto clothing or forming bracelets or necklaces. In association with the perforated beads, a number of blanks were also found, suggesting that the Nab Head site was a production centre for bead making. Similar perforated shale beads have also been found at a number of other sites, including Manton Warren and Humberside, Newquay, Cardigan Churn, and Starcar in Yorkshire, as well as Staple Crag in County Durham. Beads of other geological types have also been found at the Upland Mid Wales site made from spotted mudstone, and single finds have been found elsewhere in Pembrokeshire. Well, there are, in fact, a lot of beads. The provenance of the Trefoil beads is interesting in that the beads from the Nav head site are dated to around the 9th millennium BCE, and the Trefoil site itself is Neolithic, a period between the two sites, giving you around about 5,000 years. Archaeologist and co-author Chris Toland-Smith does express some caution due to the limited dating of the Nav head site, which could therefore mean the beads may be more recent. Or it could be that the idea and the meaning of the adornment, through perforating and wearing shale and shale beads, extended into the Neolithic. It could also mean that the beads originated from a much earlier phase of the Trefoil monument, when it was being used perhaps by these Mesolithic hunter-gatherers. There's enough possibilities there, but then, of course, that's the beauty of research, hoping to find out the answer. The early use of Neolithic burial ritual monuments is not uncommon in Western Britain. The long mounds at Arthur Stone, for example, and Gwern Vale. Further excavation planned for the summer may reveal more at Trefoil's possible Mesolithic past. An image of one of the more recently discovered drilled shale beads is available on the Stone Pages website. Now, ancient stone carvings dating back at least 10,000 years have been found by a team of Australian scientists in a cave at East Timor, an island at the south end of the maritime Southeast Asia. The findings, just published in the journal Antiquity, follow the discovery in the Lenihara cave in May 2009. The team of archaeologists and paleontologists have been looking for the fossilised remains of extinct giant rats, but Dr. Ken Applin from the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation accidentally saw the stylized face carvings in the limestone roof. One of his East Timorese colleagues was sitting on the top of a large block of limestone. He looked up to see what was doing, and as he did so, his head torch shone across the faces on the limestone. The Lenihara petroglyphs are frontal stylized faces, each with eyes and nose and a mouth. One of them even has a circular headdress with rays that frame the face. Although stylized engravings of faces occur throughout Melanesia, Australia and the Pacific, the Lenihara petroglyphs are the only examples that have been dated to the Pleistocene. No other petroglyphs of faces are known to exist anywhere else on the island of Timor. And if you want to see more on that, including the faces, well, get yourself along to Past Horizons, www.pasthorizons.com, and you'll see this and many more stories. Now, new archaeological findings suggest that the Vikings considered Stone Age objects to have magical qualities, and that such objects were more important in Viking culture than previously understood. Examinations of around 10 Viking graves found in Rogaland, southwest Norway, revealed Stone Age items such as weapons, amulets and tools. Ole Hemdorf of the Archaeological Museum in Stavanger said that he believes the items were buried so that they would protect and bring luck to the dead in the afterlife. The latest revelations are linked to discoveries from Vikings who previously travelled to Iceland and who had been found to be carrying Stone Age items with them. Previously, such findings were not considered to be significant, but recent analysis links them to similar, earlier overlooked evidence from several locations over the former Viking lands. As well as being buried with the dead, Stone Age arrowheads and daggers were sometimes buried under Viking houses. Hermdorf suggests that by including objects from their ancestors, the Vikings were legitimising and gaining control of the past. The custom of burying Stone Age treasures has also been identified in Iron Age communities, and excavations from the Age of Migration between 400 and 600 BCE found in Norway, Sweden and Denmark. Indeed, this practice is mentioned in William Shakespeare's Hamlet, where it's stated that flint, pottery, round stones and shards are all thrown into Ophelia's grave. I think I might do that myself. Anyway, finally, a 4,000-year-old standing stone in Angus, Scotland, has fallen over due to severe winter weather. Believe me, the Carlin Well Stone at Airlie near Kirriemuir toppled over as the snow and ice and frost from a long cold spell melted away. The 2-metre-high prehistoric standing stone is situated on the crest of a knoll near a farm. Human remains have been found near the Shedgell Monument at the end of the 18th century. Historic Scotland is now looking to carry out a small investigative dig on the site before reinstating the stone. Spokeswoman said that they were contacted by the landowner and had a meeting with them. Fortunately, the stone was not damaged in any way, and the owner has cordoned the stone off to protect it from grazing stock. Prehistoric standing stones such as this commonly have relatively shallow footings, and the 2,000 years of soil erosion can lead to instability. They will be investigating options about exactly how to reinstate the stone. Historic Scotland is hoping to arrange for an archaeological excavation around the base of the standing stone, followed by its full reinstatement. Well, I cannot believe that we've managed to get to the end of this one. Do not forget, of course, that news is now available on the iPhone, iPod Touch and iPad. If you get yourself along to www.stonepages.com/app. And, of course, there's the fabulous Past Horizons website with news, articles, opinions, archaeological tools and, of course, projects and videos from around the world. www.pasthorizons.com. Can I remind people that many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities can be found on my own website. That's Badger. www.bajr.org. And remember that more can always be found at Stonepages. news.stonepages.com. Thanks for listening to Archaeology News Weekly. We hope you return again to us next week.